Hello to you all. Welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Chassaigne here with you for the next half hour. Today's show will be mostly about housing. We'll go to Halifax, where the housing minister wants to get construction projects rolling.
The amendments will remove barriers, increase density, and ensure that housing remains a priority focus in our most urban center.
And then to Montreal, where protesters met at the Olympic Stadium to disturb Housing Minister Hélène Duranceau's speech at the East Summit. In Peterborough, Ontario, 50 shipping containers will be transformed into a new housing community for the homeless.
How does it feel to move into one of these
units?
I think it's
going to be cool and awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be great to be off the street and in somewhere warm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cold at night.
Things are looking up in Kitchener. 500 new affordable housing units will be built. Nothing compared to the 65,000 units Toronto's planning for the year 2030.
So while the cost of delivering this housing plan is big, the cost of inaction is even bigger, up to $8 billion per year in lost revenues as well as lost productivity.
And Terry Teague, BC's Assembly of First Nations Regional Chief, is working to find solutions to the housing crisis as well.
It just hasn't kept up in terms of these changing times. And clearly, as we come out of the pandemic, it has exacerbated the issue of homelessness, and not only in Prince George, but elsewhere in British Columbia and elsewhere in North America.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks for being with us. So we all heard in the federal fall economic statement presented by Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland, the focus will be on housing for quite a while. Billions are being invested over the next few years, and announcements no doubt will be pouring in. The objective being to add 30,000 additional rental units across the country in the short term to help satisfy needs, which will reach more than 3 million units by 2030. Efforts are being made by all levels of government to help Canadians looking for an affordable place to stay. Municipalities from across the country have been on that case for months and years. As we will hear during the show, building projects are well on their way. But to get to that point, sometimes many regulations and bylaws need to be changed. Out east, Nova Scotia's Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing, John Lohr, has been facing opposition. The minister is looking to speed things up by amending housing bylaws across the province to get more homes built faster. Lohr has suggested streamlining development bylaws for every municipality. The proposed amendments come after the province's Bill 329 received criticism from the Halifax Regional Municipality. The bill, which passed during the fall legislative session, will give the housing minister the power to approve development in the HRM without consultation from regional council or community councils. More on this story with Haley DiRizio in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Madam Speaker, over the past 2 years, we've been working on a number of fronts with all levels of government, businesses, and community partners on solutions. But we need to do more, and we need to do better for our residents. The amendments to the Halifax Regional Municipality Charter and the Housing in Halifax Regional Municipality Act will remove barriers, increase density, and ensure that housing remains a priority focus in our most urban center. Madam Speaker, these intended amendments are intended to enhance our work with HRM. We've done a lot of great work together on the housing file, and I'm confident we will continue to do so.
Leader of the Liberal Party, Zach Churchill, says the amendments made to Bill 329 could allow favoritism by the provincial government when it comes to choosing developers.
There's no reason to want to hide any of this information from the public if the government has confidence that no untoward decisions are going to be made or that no favoritism is going to be had on this. And we've seen this happen with the PC government in Ontario. Again, no, not the same exact legislation, not the same situation, but there are similarities there. The legislation that was moved in Ontario allowed the minister, as I've talked about previously, to engage in favoritism, overrule local decision-making and local planning, and pick winners. And they just so happened to be developers that had ties to the party and donated to the party and that the minister's chief of staff had met with.
Leader of the NDP, Claudia Chender, says the housing minister should not have the authority to override housing experts.
We have a Minister of Housing and Municipal Affairs who I'm sure has immersed himself in the work of the department, but he's certainly not a planner. And so we are, as I think has been said, laying the ground for corruption. When we see a situation where the public service can be overridden, where other orders of government and their input can be dismissed, where decisions can be made behind closed doors, alarm bells should go up. That is not a democratic way of doing things.
Hi, I'm Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to Viewpoints.
And housing is, of course, making headlines in Montreal, where protesters took to Montreal's Olympic Stadium to denounce a Bill 31 proposed by Quebec's housing minister, France-Hélène Duranceau. The controversial bill promises to end lease transfers and shift from social to affordable housing investment. On November 13, protesters gathered around the Sommet de l'Est, the East End Summit, organized by the Chamber of Commerce of the East of Montreal. The summit featured Montreal Mayor Valérie Plante, Environment and Climate Change Minister Stephen Guilbeault, and Provincial Housing Minister France-Hélène Duranceau, among others. And participants got more than they bargained for, as some 100 protesters disturbed the meeting to call for greater tenant protections and the right to housing in the province. A few protesters even made it into the room where the Housing Minister France-Hélène Duranceau was speaking. More on this with Jules Bugel.
Monday's Sommet de l'Est, or Summit of the East, was disrupted by protesters calling for greater tenant protections in Quebec. The event was put on by the Chamber of Commerce of the East of Montreal and invited business leaders and politicians at different levels of government to speak about business development and innovation in Montreal's East End. Quebec Housing Minister France-Hélène Duranceau was giving an address when protesters from the Front de lutte pour un immobilier populaire took to the stage. They held a banner condemning the proposed Bill 31, which would end lease transfers in the province and facilitate a shift of provincial money from social to affordable housing projects.
On voudrait vous parler des 100 000 logements abordables disparus qui ont disparu depuis 2018, des 50 000 foyers à la rue chaque année au Québec, des 75% d'augmentation des loyers depuis 2002.
In the audience, protesters shared statistics illustrating Quebec's worsening housing crisis and denounced the government's inaction.
Alors vous allez vous adresser où, Madame Duranceau? Combien d'évictions? Combien de logements perdus? Combien de familles à la rue?
How many evictions? How many homes lost? How many families in the streets? How many encampments? How many suicides will it take you to face the problem? Protesters asked Duranceau. They also criticized the minister for meeting with 10 landlord associations and no tenants groups. Members of the RECLAC were also demonstrating outside of the Olympic Stadium, where the summit took place. They've critiqued both the contents and the process of Bill 31, which has seen roughly two-thirds of the proposed legislation get a rewrite in recent weeks. The demonstrators cleared out by the afternoon. Police report no arrests were made. I'm Jules Bugel. Thanks for listening.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
Next, we're hopping over to Ontario to visit a community where one unusual housing project is almost ready to go. It's called the Wolf Street Modular Housing Community. This housing community is built from shipping containers. It is located directly across the street from an existing tent encampment on Wolf Street, where Jocelyn Blasey, homelessness and data program manager for Peterborough Social Services, estimates that 55 people experiencing homelessness are living. Of those 55 people, 40 of them will be moving into the modular housing units. The remaining 15 will be receiving support from outreach staff from the city and other community organizations. The Modular Bridge Housing Community is scheduled to open in the coming weeks. Journalist Edward Sweeney got to take a first look inside the nearly completed units.
The long-awaited completion of the Wolf Street Modular Bridge Housing Community is right around the corner.
How does it feel to move into one of these units?
I think it's going to be cool and awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be great to be off the street and in somewhere warm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cold at night.
You just heard Chelsea and Vanessa, Two of the people who will be moving into the 50 modular housing units on Wolf Street, scheduled to open this fall season. And that move-in day is getting closer and closer. There was an open house viewing of the site on Wolf Street on the morning of Friday, November 17th, to show off the units and the site's facilities to the public and to have connected City of Peterborough officials answer any questions. Trent Radio met with Jocelyn Blasey, the Homelessness and Data Program Manager for Social Services, and Jessica Penner, Program Manager for the Modular Bridge Housing Community, inside one of these modular homes to talk about the program. Here is Penner describing what the units look like inside.
The inside of a cabin is about 12 and a half feet by about 7, and each cabin's provided with a bed, a double bed, bed frame, a mini fridge, a recycling box, a laundry hamper, towels, a quilt that's been donated, and then there's some furniture that they get to choose. So there's windows on the door, heat, air conditioning, lights. That's sort of the basics of the cabin, and then people will get to set it up how they like.
In addition to the 50 single-person housing units, there is a bathroom unit equipped with 5 bathrooms, each with a shower, and a small building for security, which will monitor the site and the entrance. Once complete, the entire site will be managed by a local harm reduction agency, the Peterborough chapter for the Elizabeth Fry Society, also called EFRI.
Yeah, so Elizabeth Fry is an organization in town. They're going to be providing supports. They're going to be the site operator. So they're going to have 2 staff on at all times. In addition to that, we will have 2 security guards on site at all times. So Elizabeth Fry is an organization who meets people where they're at, supporting folks in the community. So they're going to be here, again, working around building care plans with individuals, supporting them with whatever that care plan looks like for each specific person. Attached to that, we also have the Wolf Street building, which is accessible by anyone. There'll be an Elizabeth Fry office there, so their staff will be able to use that space as needed. There's also 2 offices that will be used as client drop-down spaces. So any agency who wants to book an office to meet with a client and meet them on site, they can book that space. In addition to that, there are some offices on the top floor of the Wolf Street building for any agencies who are spending a lot of time down here, that they can request an office and have space down here to meet with their clients. And security is on site to keep individuals and residents safe.
The future residents I spoke to, Chelsea and Vanessa, are hopeful and excited about the security presence on site.
No, I'm happy with the security. I love that there's security. Yeah, that you have to wave yourself in. Yeah.
You have to come in every day and say you're checking in. And
guests have to sign in.
Yeah, guests have to sign in. So that's pretty cool.
And though there will soon be 50 individuals moving into these modular housing units, there are still many without housing. Directly across the street from where we were is an encampment of people living in tents.
Yeah, so prior to individuals moving from the main Wolf Street lot where we are right now over to what we call the South Lot, there were about 55 individuals. I would say it's also hard to gather a number on that because it's a fairly transient space. But in addition to the Wolf Street site here, the city's also working with One City to open the Trinity Community Center, which will provide overnight space for 6 months of the year for individuals to be able to access overnight space as well.
Of the roughly 55 people currently living at the Wolf Street tent encampment, 40 of them will be moving into the modular units when they're ready. The remaining 15 people will receive assistance from the outreach teams there and will receive help moving into other overnight shelters, like the Trinity Community Center. It is still uncertain when the units will be ready for residents to move in, as Blasey says here.
We're working on a timeline of a few weeks, but before winter.
This has been Eddie Sweeney reporting for the Local Journalism Initiative here in Peterborough, Ngozi-Wanong.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
Meanwhile, on November 8th in Toronto, City Council approved a building project that would see 65,000 affordable houses built by 2030. The project, called Housing TO, located on Sherbourne Street, is part of a city-owned property currently used as a parking lot. The City of Toronto will also be dedicating more city-owned land for affordable rental and accelerating housing-ready projects on city and non-profit-owned land. The new homes in the city will either be affordable, rent geared to income, or market rental homes. The estimated cost for this project could reach more than $30 billion over the next 7 years. Details with Owen Thompson in Toronto, Ontario.
Velissa Farah, Director of Housing Policy and Strategy, Toronto, says that while the cost of action is high, inaction will end up costing the city more.
So while the cost of delivering this housing plan is big, the cost of inaction is even bigger. We've seen a report by Wood Green and the Board of Trade in July 2021, which estimated that the cost of inaction, specifically the cost related to lack of affordable housing for key workers and lower-income residents in our city, is costing Toronto and the Greater Toronto Area up to $8 billion per year in lost revenues as well as lost productivity. And occupations that have been priced out of the private rental and ownership market includes cashiers, administrative staff, nurses, custodians, and restaurant workers, who are really key to driving both our social and economic success. And we know that a lack of affordable housing and purpose-built homes in general is also impacting not only these key workers, but employers in all sectors of our economy, including large employers like our financial institutions, as well as the IT sector.
To hit the new goal of affordable houses, there will be an increased role for nonprofit, cooperative, and Indigenous housing providers. The report outlines ways for these three types of public housing to obtain more funding to continue with their ongoing plans. This would include reaching out to multiple organizations on top of the federal and provincial governments to set up a, quote, sustainable Toronto Housing Affordability Fund, unquote. In the report, it says that there are 51 city housing sites across Toronto. Once the housing is built, the report says that the 51 sites will contribute 16,000 to 17,000 new homes in the city, with all the homes being either affordable, rent geared to income, or market rental homes. Abby Bond, Executive Director of the Housing Secretariat, says,
Many of you are very familiar with some of the challenges being experienced in our city. We have now over 10,000 people who are experiencing homelessness each night, and around 48% of our households are renters, and many of them, 40% of those, are living in unaffordable housing. There is one in five of our households who are living in core housing need, and that is double the national average. So whatever housing and homelessness crisis is being experienced in Canada, it is being experienced more pointedly in Toronto.
Just to put things in perspective, the Canadian Federation of Municipalities estimates building 5.8 million new homes by 2030 would cost $600 billion.
You're listening to Viewpoints with Boris Sassang.
And the plan seems to be the same all across the country, including in Kitchener, where a mayor, Barry Vrbanovich, announced new housing incentives to build affordable housing in the city. Starting in 2024, the city of Kitchener, with the help of the federal government, will offer incentives to build not-for-profit, supportive, and affordable rentals or affordable co-op units. The initiative's goal is to help construct more than 500 new affordable housing units and will cost $5 million. Mayor Vrbanovich describes the program.
Starting in 2024, a $5,000 per unit matching grant funded by the federal government and the city of Kitchener, plus a no-interest loan of an additional $5,000 per unit, will be made available to assist with more than 500 new affordable housing units. Funding will help cover early project costs for developments that provide non-for-profit supportive, affordable rental, or affordable co-op housing units, and will also help enable housing permissions to permit 4 units on residential lots citywide.
This housing announcement comes on the heels of last week's announcement by Federal Minister Sean Fraser that $42.4 million of funding from the Government of Canada's Housing Accelerator Fund will fast-track the construction of 1,200 new local homes by early 2027. The Housing Accelerator Fund was launched by the federal government in March of this year to assist municipalities to increase the housing supply.
As Minister Sean Fraser pointed out when he announced our funding last week, Kitchener will have the most significant growth rate of any accelerator fund applicant in Canada.
Other announcements the mayor made in his address include changes to the community centre model to reflect changing and more diverse neighbourhoods and to help newcomers become more connected to the community. The mayor talked about the city's efforts to build a creative and ideas hub downtown and also announced a new relationship structure between the city and local performing arts organizations.
We're also reigniting this city by breathing new life into culture and entertainment. And let me be clear, we're not just talking about it, we're actively making it happen. The city is taking on a new leadership role to support city-owned performing arts and entertainment facilities. The Center in the Square, the Odd, the Registry Theater, and the Conrad Center for the Performing Arts. This means working with our valued venue operators and community partners in the arts and culture space on shared services, operational support, and promotion.
Well, the mayor discussed details about housing, the idea hub, the environment, and changes to community centers and the relationship between the city and the performing arts institutions. He did not talk in detail about the affordability crisis or the growing homelessness crisis. I'm MP Home. Thanks for listening.
And this will come as no surprise. A recent survey conducted by Rentals.ca shows that you'll pay more in Vancouver than anywhere else in Canada for a one-bedroom apartment. The one-bedroom rent in Vancouver costs $2,872 a month, compared to $2,607 in Toronto, $2,056 in Ottawa, $1,284 in Edmonton, $1,800 in Montreal, and just a bit more, $1,875 in Halifax.
Hi, I'm Kareem Mosna in Kingston, Ontario. You are tuned to Viewpoints.
And tracking rent affordability in British Columbia has been a high priority for BC's Assembly of First Nations Regional Chief, Terry Tegee. Chief Tegee is from the Takla Nation, located in the north-central BC, about 400 kilometers north of Prince George. He recently spoke at the Assembly of First Nations Housing Conference in late October in Prince George about strategies and solutions to the housing crisis. The speakers at the conference provided many ideas about housing that many communities, Indigenous and non-Indigenous alike, can use. And Chief Tegee has been involved in the Prince George Aboriginal Housing Society's Parkwood Plaza project, currently underway in BC. An important feature of the complex is its affordability. Here he is talking with Ian Gregg in Prince George, BC.
In our community of Prince George, and really the wider province of BC, and you could say across Canada, even North America, we're looking at a housing crisis. The way you see it right now, what are some things in place now that are actually helping to remedy? What's working right now?
Well, I suppose what's working here in Prince George is the Prince George Aboriginal Housing Society, which has built new spaces for First Nations, such as the one just near Parkwood, 200 plus spaces. We need more of that type of building, which is, I think, had a lot of input from First Nations here in the urban center of Prince George, which had, I suppose, culturally appropriate. And moreover, and this is the most important part, is that it's affordable. I think the affordability in urban centers is, especially in British Columbia, Vancouver, and elsewhere, Kelowna, we see many homeless people, and it's not just First Nations. You know, we make up a big portion, such as here in British, the homeless people here in Prince George is up to 70%, but, you know, elsewhere too. But that being said, is that, you know, despite the fact we make 5-6% of the population, more often than not, we are overrepresented in terms of homelessness. So I think, you know, more spaces need to be built and more affordability. Part of the solution too is building homes back in our First Nations community. So one of the issues there is that as we come out of the pandemic is that, you know, the resources to build those homes is doesn't keep up with the inflation, doesn't keep up with the rising costs of being in remote communities. So many of our First Nations communities are not only dealing with the shortcomings of not having enough resources, but then you're dealing with the increased cost of inflation, increased cost of building homes. So, you know, the other issue with homes in urban centers is public policy. in particular the municipal government and provincial government perhaps may be at odds in terms of finding places and spaces to build affordable housing. It just hasn't kept up in terms of these changing times. And clearly, as we come out of the pandemic, it has exacerbated the issue of homelessness, and not only in Prince George, but elsewhere in British Columbia and elsewhere in North America. I mean, just look at Seattle, the tens of thousands in Los Angeles that are homeless. They're really struggling with the public policy and also the affordability housing crisis. I think perhaps an alignment with the, I suppose, ideology of many First Nations is to implement the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous People. It is law here in British Columbia and in Canada now, and has been adopted by the City of Vancouver. So, you know, that's one place that perhaps governing bodies, you know, those that are elected in these elected positions can look to perhaps follow in terms of what next to do. I think, you know, UNDRIP allows for recognition of sovereignty and self-determination, free, prior, informed consent. But I think, moreover, it's, you know, the recognition that perhaps housing should be, you know, a human right, just like water, you know, safe drinking water should be a human right. You know, all of these things that many are afforded, and really it isn't an issue in the general public, but there is a part of our society that are left vulnerable, and more often than not, it is made up of Indigenous peoples, a high majority, and that's really a problem. So, you know, we're looking on all levels of government, now, Indigenous governance, municipal, provincial, and federal policy to perhaps allow for some of the solutions to come to the fore so we can really resolve this issue back in our communities and perhaps in urban centers such as Prince George.
And we close the show by lightening things up to let you know that a rare local eclipse of the sun will be happening in spring 2024. Yes, the first total eclipse of the sun since 1349 will happen this spring. And Prince Edward County is in a unique position to view this rare occurrence. The eclipse will happen on April 8th, 2024. Here's Brenda Little in Picton, Ontario.
The first total eclipse of the sun since 1349 will happen this spring, and Prince Edward County is in a unique position. It's in the path of totality, providing some of the best viewing of this event in Ontario and giving the county a unique opportunity for both tourism and education. The county's Municipal Emergency Control Group and community partners recently discussed plans covering traffic control, safety, and communications. The county itself also plans to explore marketing opportunities as the date draws closer. During the April eclipse, the moon will completely block the sun for 3 minutes and 2 seconds, starting at 3:21 in the afternoon. The next eclipse of this magnitude and location will not take place until 2399. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Brenda Little.
Well, that's it for us this week. Thanks to all our journalists, Haley DiRizio, MP Holmes, Edward Sweeney, Jules Bigiel, Owen Thompson, Brenda Little, National Coordinators Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and your local radio station. I'm Boris Chassaigne, your host and producer. Until next week, ciao.
Canada-info.ca.
broadcasting on the internet and at 9